Hello, I'm Richard Lee. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. To get 10% off your first purchase, just head to squarespace.com/guardian. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. Here on the Books Desk, we spend most of our time focused on beginnings. We talk to authors, editors and agents about the hard-won knowledge that goes into an authoritative study, the straightforward bravery that underpins an honest memoir, the mysterious inspirations that ignite the flame of a novel. But what then? How does a book make the leap from manuscript to bookshop shelf, and what happens after that? Our story opens at Carmelite House, Hachette UK's shiny new headquarters on London's Victoria Embankment, where Hodder & Stoughton's director of production, Joanna Seaton, begins the tale as an author's work arrives on an editor's desk.
The first thing that will happen is that the manuscript will come in to the editor, and they will do what's called a structural edit. So they will work with the author to make sure that the manuscript is as good as it can be. And then they, once the probably is, will be quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and rewriting, but once they're happy with that, then the manuscript goes off to a copy editor. And mostly the copy editors are out of house. They're freelance, but some publishers do still have in-house copy editors. But generally that's somebody out of house. And that's quite good because it's a fresh pair of eyes. And so they copy edit and make sure that they're happy with the manuscript. And copy editing tends to be more grammatical changes or things like if a character is leaving Paddington Station and going to Edinburgh, it would be something like that, picking up those sort of factual errors. And then the copy edit manuscript comes back in. Once everybody is happy with that, then it finally comes through to production, and that's when we get involved. So we then send the copy edited manuscript out to a typesetter and get that typeset. That's less, in the old days, that would be somebody sitting on a massive typesetting machine, and they would actually go through and key the manuscript from a hard copy, taking in any of those copy edited changes as they did that. But now much more we get the manuscript as a digital file, so it's more about formatting that and making it look good on the page and not be too spacey and then too cramped, so that it's a good reading experience. Once the manuscript is typeset, it comes back into us in the form of page proofs, which then go to the author, agent and a proofreader. And the editor here also looks at them. So everybody reads that and then they send their changes in, and those changes are collated onto one set of page proofs, goes back to the typesetter. Typesetter takes in those changes, we get another set of page proofs, and so we go backwards and forwards, till it's beautiful, and there are no more corrections, hopefully, fingers crossed. And then at that stage, we get a portable digital file format, a PDF, which we can print from, and that's a fixed format file, so we can send that to the printer, and they can actually print the book. At the same time that all that is happening, the cover is going through similar stages. Obviously, the cover doesn't come initially from the author, but the brief that the editor does is discussed with the author to make sure that they're happy, because the cover is a visual representation of their book as well as a selling tool. And so that is then designed in the art department in-house and, again, goes through various changes of being checked and corrected and checked and corrected till everybody is happy. And then that hopefully will come together at the same time as the text file, and we'll send it all off together.
The next chapter takes us to Suffolk, where a cluster of vast warehouses looms over the small town of Bungay. Clays has been printing on this 19-acre site for more than 100 years. As specialists in making monochrome paperbacks and hardbacks, which is to say the bulk of the books on our shelves, the process at Clays is divided into two streams. Covers are produced by two sheet-fed colour printers in a room lined with plastic tubs of custom-mixed inks that smell a bit like varnish, while the pages are produced on one of six digital or 14 lithographic presses, huge machines that can spin out 17,064-page sections of a book in an hour. Twisting and turning along the walkways that thread through the factory, customer service manager Chris Impey heads for the moment when the digital files received from the publisher meet the physical realm.
We're currently standing in the plate room. This is where we make our plates ready to go into the web room. It's a low-ceilinged, broad room with these massive, long machines in. What do these machines do?
These machines are producing plates. What we do is at one end, we are feeding in aluminium flat plates. They have a coating across them. And what we're doing is we're taking the image from the file where we want the ink to appear on the page. And what we're doing is lasering that image onto the coating. And what happens is that coating is hardened. And then as it comes through the process, we then wash away with a solution to end up with a plate where all we can see is the image that we actually want to appear on the paper.
And the image here is an image of words, as it were.
Indeed, yes. It can be words. It can also be what we would call an integrated image as well. So a picture or some kind of line drawing as well.
How big are these sheets? They're quite thin, I suppose, but they're quite broad.
They are, yes. I mean, they measure approximately a metre and a half by about a metre and a half, so roughly square. And within there, you can have up to, well, in total, 96 pages per pair of plates when we're printing on press.
Why is it a pair of plates?
Because we're printing on the inside and also the outside of the paper at the same time as it's going through the press.
And each of these plates will print about how many books in its before you need to do another one?
We would recommend you would print up to a maximum of 100,000, but certainly for this type of printing, conventional printing as we call it, you would print in the region of 4,000 upwards.
So these things are going to be pressed onto the paper with some ink, and then that's the pages?
Yeah, there is a process in between whereby what we're doing is layering the ink onto the plate. The plate then is, the image is transferred onto what we call a blanket. Now, the blanket is a rubber-type surface. The image is then applied from that blanket directly onto the paper. So that is what is physically touching the paper.
And so where do we go next?
Okay, so what we'll do now is we'll go into the web room where we actually take these plates and we wrap them around a cylinder within the web press. And so as we were saying earlier, there's two plates per section of a book. So we can go into the web room and take a look at that. All right.
The web room is a vast booming hangar filled with the rattle and hum of 14 hulking lithographic presses, each one taller than a man and set up to produce books of varying size.
So we've just come into the web room. This is where we have taken those plates from the plate room, loading them into our web press.
So this is lithographic printing?
Indeed, yes. This is offset lithographic printing.
And you do both lithographic and digital here?
Yes, well, on this particular machine, this is conventional printing as we call it. And so this is where we load in the plates. For digital printing, plates do not exist. Quite simply, digital printing is where we release the ink and drop it in microscopic droplets of ink are dropped onto the paper, and there is no physical contact between any form of plate or blanket with the text paper.
That's the printing press just spinning up now?
Yes, indeed, yeah. So it's just getting up to speed now. And we, as we make our way around the press, we can see the sections coming out. They have already been folded. And once we get fully up to speed, we can actually run at whatever the maximum number is.
Scientific.
Initially, a large reel of paper is being fed in at this front end. It goes through a number of pre-tensioning bars to make sure that the tension of the paper is correct. So too tight, there is a risk of the paper snapping. And too loose, then the paper can move around as well. What then happens is going through the middle section of the press where the plates have been loaded. So both set of plates are loaded in there, along with the blanket, where the ink is then transferring, as we mentioned earlier, from the plate onto the blanket and then onto the paper. So printing on the front and the reverse of the paper. Once it is printed, then the paper is spliced and then fed into the folder. At that point, then we are folding that into sections, and the sections are then coming out of the back end of the press. We are loading them up into bundles, so we put Strapex around and we load them onto a pallet. At this stage, what we're doing is only printing one single section of the book.
And this machine can do 17,000 sections an hour?
It can, yes, 17,000 sections an hour. And what we will do is, once we've printed sufficient of one section, we will then stop the press, open up, change the plates, close it back up again, and we start the process again for the next section of the book. over the far side, you'll see that these are actually stacked right up to the ceiling. And this area is absolutely full of text sections for various different titles that we've got going through at the moment.
We've got The Rest Is Noise in front of us here.
We have indeed, yes, yes. So we can see that we have two sections of that book on one pallet there. And once we gather all of that book together, then it's actually made available to go through into our binding area, where it will then come together with the covers for that book.
But this venerable company is in the middle of a huge shift as digital technology transforms the business of putting ink onto paper.
What we have in front of us now is one of our larger digital presses.
So these are all comparatively new in the factory, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Compared to the conventional presses, yes, they are very much newer than those. And the main difference in this is that there are no plates, so there is no stopping the press and changing a set of plates in order to move on to the next part of the book. What this will do is print the whole book in one go. So it'll print from page one right through to the last page in one go, rather than stopping and starting and only producing part of the book.
It's just like a massive inkjet printer.
Yes, it is. I wish I could say it was something more than that, but it is a huge printer. Amazing technology when you look at it, because what it's doing is, through microscopic little nozzles, it is actually firing that or dropping that ink onto the paper.
What kind of proportion of your work here these days is done digitally, and what proportion is the lithographic?
Certainly, as far as the number of orders that we receive, then I would say that we are moving towards 50% of our orders are printing digitally. As far as volume, then it's certainly a lot less than that.
And that's because you're able to do smaller print runs with the digital?
We are, yes, absolutely. I mean, for one of our presses, we can print anything from 1 to 20 books in what we call print-on-demand technology. And this press that you're seeing here would print anything from 20 up to about 4,000 copies.
And then anything more than 4,000, you're on the lithographic machine?
That's correct, yes. That would traditionally be the most cost-effective way to do, because these machines, the digital machines, will not run as fast as the conventional press. So as soon as you tip over that 4,000 mark, it's actually more efficient to stop the press, change the plates, and then lose that time, because the speed at which the machine runs means that it is far more efficient to print the larger print runs through conventional printing.
According to Joanna Seaton, with Hodder and Stoughton producing 10 million books a year, the decision about how many copies to print of each title is a combination of science and art.
Obviously, we're forecasting throughout the pre-press stages of that book. So sales are talking to the retailers. We're getting feedback from all sorts of people. Publicity and marketing are talking to people. So we try and get an idea of how big the book is going to be. And then when we actually make the decision on what we're going to print, we sit down and we look at the orders that we've already got and the orders that we're going to get or hoping to get. And we work it out on that basis.
More of a science or more of an art?
The figures are scientific. I'm sure the inventory manager would want me to say that it is very scientific, but it is also an art, and that's why it's good that the inventory manager is very experienced and he knows how everything works and is aware of the types of books that we've got and what is possibly going to happen with them.
As printing technology improves, are you able to do smaller, more frequent runs? Is that the trend?
Yes, absolutely. So we are printing, for frontlist titles, we might be printing 100,000 copies, or we might only be printing 1,000 copies. It can be really varied. But what we always know is that we can reprint really quickly, and we more and more are trying to print to orders that we have rather than printing up front and then hoping that those books will sell, because we really don't want to hold a lot of stock and we don't have room to hold a lot of stock. And also, nobody wants to print loads of books that they're not going to sell.
Little Deaths is the acclaimed debut novel by Emma Flint about a notorious child murder case in New York in the sweltering summer of 1965. Accusatory fingers are pointed by the police, the press and the neighbourhood at the children's mother, Ruth Malone. She's secretive, loose and unconventional, but is she capable of murder? The Guardian called Little Deaths riveting and a strong addition to the growing trend of domestic dystopias. Keep listening to the end of the podcast for an exclusive extract.
Whether it's digitally printed or produced on a conventional lithographic press, Back at the factory, the next stage for the 150 million books Clays produces every year is in the binding section, where the inside pages are brought together with the cover.
What it's doing now is it's creating the entire book block of that book. It will then turn it up onto its end to ensure that all of the spine sections are aligned. At that point, then, we will actually clamp that book into place, because what we need to do is we need to actually apply glue into that spine. At the moment, if all we did was just apply glue to the, as it was, it will only apply glue to the outer sheets of that of each one of those sections. So what we do in order to get the glue penetrated into the back of the book is that we actually shave 3 millimetres of paper out of the back. It then goes through a sander that roughs that spine up, and then we apply what we call a hot melt glue. At about 170 degrees centigrade, that glue then penetrates into the spine, straight away bringing all of those pages together as a complete book. Immediately after that, what we will then do is apply another layer of glue in order that we can then apply the cover to the book. Once that's actually applied, it will then fold the cover around the book block, and at that point there's a great deal of heat in the spine of the book. At that point, if you were to cut the book and start to trim it, you would actually draw the glue across the pages. So what we do is we send it off on a cooling belt. So it goes the complete length of the room on a cooling conveyor belt. It goes all the way back on itself until eventually it gets to a point where it's then cool enough that then we can start to cut the book, separate the book up, and then start to trim that book down into the finished article.
Just takes a tour around the building.
It does indeed, yes.
So here we've got Cradle and All by James Patterson. Just finished its tour around the building, is ready to be trimmed.
It is, yeah. And this particular machine, it can actually produce up to 20,000 books an hour. So this really does work very, very hard for us. It's also running 24 hours a day, anything up to 7 days a week. So what we're looking at now is the very final stage of the trimming of this book. So it will now appear to this part of the process in still a very rough and ready state. The book cannot actually be opened and on the foredge fully. So in order to be able to open these pages, we now need to trim it down to the final finished size of the book. So at this stage there are 3 incredibly sharp blades that will then come down onto the book. So we take that book, we clamp it into place, and then with those 3 blades, we are then trimming the foredge and the head and the tail of the book. At that point, it's then a fully completed, finished book, ready for packing.
And so then these finished books are stacked into the pallets and then into the 20 articulated lorries going out the front door?
Yes, indeed, yeah. These will automatically, on this particular machine, our largest machine, the Corona, these will automatically disappear off onto a conveyor belt and get loaded onto a pallet. Once that pallet's full, it will then disappear off into our distribution area, where it will then either go off into, be loaded directly onto the back of a lorry if it's due out today, or it may be held into our high bay storage area if it's going out in a number of days' time.
And you're sending books, what, all over the UK, all over the world?
Yes, indeed, yeah. We send them off to shippers who will then send them throughout the world, but also numerous warehouses, either warehouses that our customers run and operate, but also we can deliver directly to the likes of Sainsbury's, Asda, Tesco's, Waterstones, their pubs as well. We will deliver directly to them.
Stand outside the factory in Bungay and you'll see up to 10 articulated lorries a day filled with huge rolls of paper reverse into the loading bay. As many as 20 more head out across the country, laden with shrink-wrapped books. The story continues in central London, deep in the bowels of Waterston's flagship store, where fiction buyer Chris White is welcoming another delivery.
This is where the books get processed. So the books arrive from what we call our hub, which is our distribution centre. So publishers and printers send the books to a place in Burton-on-Trent. They all get processed and they get shipped out to our shops. This is our largest shop, Piccadilly. And yes, over here is where the books get processed. Once they've been processed, they're ready to go out on the shop floor.
Door is open. Going up. Door closed.
Up on the third floor, Among tables decked with stylish grey classics from Persephone and translated fiction from Pushkin Press, White gestures around the spacious fiction section to give some idea of the scale of operations at the UK's biggest bookseller's biggest shop.
Doors open. Going up.
So how many books would pass through Waterstones at Piccadilly each year?
Waterstones in Piccadilly is about 1.5 million books are sold each year, and they're about 8 miles worth of shelving. I think at any one time they have 150,000 set different titles. Quite how many books they have on the shelf at any one time is a slightly movable feast.
And so how do you decide which books it's going to be? How do you decide which ones appear here?
Well, it's a slightly... So in a shop like this, which is our largest shop, there will be, in addition to our central buying, there will be a lot of local curation and local enhancement. So we will buy our sort of core central offer, which is quite a large core central offer. But in addition to that, they will make their decisions based on locality and their market. And obviously, being in the centre of London, that market is quite broad, so they can afford to diversify. The actual merchandising of the books is down to the shop team, and that
you mean the kind of layout.
Exactly, so this lovely table of Persephone books here, for example, this isn't something we've dictated from the office upstairs. This is something which the shop team has decided to put together because it works for their market, and that is true of every shop in the estate. We used to have a more dictatorial attitude towards merchandising in shops. That attitude has now completely disappeared, and basically the stock we send them, the shops and the books sellers are trained to merchandise that stock as effectively as possible for their market.
So how much of what you decide in terms of what you're deciding to buy, how much of that is data and how much of that just a feel about the books?
It's a combination of both. So where there is data available, and so for more brand-led fiction, for example, where you have somebody who's producing a book a year, you know how many copies you sold of the last hardback, you know their sales trajectory, and you can make your decisions based on that.
You mean a writer like kind of Ian Rankin or Val McDermott?
Yeah, I didn't want to name names, but yeah, you have an anticipation, and it's quite easy to base your decisions on what they've sold previously, and then obviously you will adjust that depending on the quality of the book, quite what the publisher is doing around that. Is there going to be a lot of publicity, marketing activity flowing from that? But where it's more interesting and more a sense of touch and feel is where it's, say, a debut literary novel and you don't have any history to base that on. So that's when you're A, backing what you think of the book, but obviously you can't make your decisions entirely based on your personal affinities. So if everything in a fiction section in Piccadilly was entirely to my taste, it would be probably quite a one-note fiction section. So you have to be thinking as a customer would think, and you have to be making your decisions based on what you think you anticipate they might like. But that's a far, far harder thing to get right.
I guess it's not a one-off decision either. I mean, how much of what you buy is determined by what's flying off the shelves?
You mean in terms of trends, or do you mean in terms of our sort of reaction to a book starting to sell?
If you make an initial order of a book, a book doesn't die after three weeks.
Yeah, well, we have quite a reactive strategy, and a lot of what I do and a lot of what the local buyers do, so there are the buyers for small clusters of shops, and what we're doing is we're looking at the sales and we're analysing quite deeply where things are working, and if something's working in one shop, for example, why isn't it working in this shop, and is that just because this shop hasn't got behind it, or this shop for some there's some local reason, maybe the author lives around the corner, you know, so you have to yes, actually we have a very reactive strategy to what we do, and it works quite well because in a sense you're letting the customer tell you what they want rather than you dictating what they should be buying.
What about publishers? Do publishers pay you money to get their books?
No, not at all. That's one of the ways it's changed completely. We used to have a model whereby publishers bought space, essentially. That doesn't happen at all anymore. So all our decisions should be made, all our buying decisions should be made based on what we think our customers want, and they should be displayed in ways we think our customers will find attractive and conducive to buying books.
What happens in the event that something doesn't wind up selling?
Well, again, we have a slightly different attitude to the attitude we used to have. We used to buy in very large volumes up front, and then sort of eye-watering proportion of that stock would then be sent back to the publisher when it hadn't sold after a couple of months. Now, we have, as discussed, a more reactive way of buying. So we will buy smaller quantities initially, and then if it works, we will buy more. And if it doesn't work, we will maybe stop buying the book. But we're trying as far as possible to make the business efficient and to not be sending vast quantities back to publishers. So our returns rate has dropped a vast percentage since James Thorne took over 4 years ago.
Because a survey in, I think, 2013 from the States found there's about 15% of books were returned. Is that the kind of level you're working at, or are you doing better than that?
We're much lower, single figure, below 5%, even getting down to about 3% now, I think, whereas previously it was much higher than 15%.
According to Karina Luke, Executive Director at Book Industry Communication, the Book Trade Supply Chain Efficiency Group, figures for the industry as a whole are hard to come up with.
It's difficult to put a number on the returns percentage, mainly because that type of information sits behind the tills, if you like.
That's so, the kind of collection point for all the data in the industry.
Yeah. So, for example, if Nielsen are reporting on sales of a particular genre of book or within a particular time period or for a particular publisher or retailer, they will have that sales information because that information has gone through the sales tills at the retailers. By definition, if a book is returned, it hasn't been sold, so it hasn't gone through the tills, so it's very difficult to get that information. From conversations I've had with retailers and publishers, I would say it's very fair to say that the trend is downwards and that we're now looking at more in the region of 10%, maybe less.
10% doesn't sound like very many, really. but if you've got 200 million copies being sold in the UK every year, that's still around 20 million books driving up and down the country. What's the point of a sales or return policy?
Well, it's getting that fine balance between having enough books out in the marketplace, in the right place, at the right time, so that people can buy them, because you don't want to be understocked. Everybody wants those sales. So it's a balancing act between your inventory manager, your distributor, your retailer, everybody working together to make sure there's an optimum number of books in the places that they're needed when they're needed.
Because if it's not on the shelf, you can't buy it.
Exactly. You know, and with the advent of sort of machine-to-machine technology and better information flows between systems, between retailers, between publishers, with the advent of some fantastic printer technologies, so, you know, a lot of publishers now can work very easily and efficiently with what is called print on demand. So there's less of a need now for publishers to be holding vast amounts of stock in their warehouse, and there's less of a need for retailers to be storing up books when the journey from printer to marketplace can be a lot faster than it ever used to be. So lots of different things influencing that side of the business. So I wouldn't say it's just one thing that's driving the returns rate down. It's a lot of contributing things. Greater efficiencies, better ways of working, all sorts of things that BIC are advocates of, supply chain efficiencies, etc. And just, you know, better management, better stock management.
What happens to the books that just don't sell?
Well, there's many reasons why books don't sell. They will come back. They will come back to the publisher or the distributor, and they will either be recycled or they will be sent to a charity, for example, Book Aid International. I know work very closely with publishers to distribute books into Africa. Everyone wants to avoid the pulping scenario. So publishers will do their best to try and avoid that and to put as much as possible back into the supply chain or back into other readers' hands.
That BIEC study found that about 5% of books published in the US are remaindered or discarded. How does that compare with the UK?
Again, it's difficult to say because those figures, because we're talking about returns, we're talking about something that doesn't have a centralised data collection point per se. That information is held at publishers separately. So there's no one place to go to get that information. So it's difficult to know exactly what that percentage would be.
But again, 5% is a lot of books, but how does that compare with other industries?
Well, to go back to the KPMG study in 99, they looked at the music industry and noted that their returns rate was between 8 to 20%. So similar. And I also believe that the food industry has substantial wastage of around about 50%. So I think just looking at those two alone, the comparison to the book industry, I think the book industry is doing very well in terms of thinking about responsibility to the environment, thinking about recycling, thinking about best practice and better ways of working and just being more efficient.
Back in 2013, that Book Industry Environmental Council report in the US suggested that only 2% of newly published books are sold at reduced prices on the remainder market, with a similar quantity heading for recycling or incineration. If those estimates hold up in the UK, then around half of the remaining 1%, around 1 million books a year, fetches up in a South London warehouse, ready to be dispatched across Africa by Book Aid International. Standing among pallets and trolleys stacked with the latest deliveries, Head of Operations Simon Mercer explains the charity's focus on brand new books.
We made a strategic decision a few years ago not to take second-hand books. Basically, because we had great supply coming in from the publishers, we didn't need second-hand books. And the work involved in processing second-hand books is huge, whereas brand new, neat, good quality books are much easier to process.
What do your partners in Africa make of that?
Without a doubt, they love us. There are a few charities that donate to books into Africa. There's one in America who's a very big donor, but they tend to give second-hand books. And whenever we go and visit our partners, they may get consignments from them as well. They always tell us that our books are far better because ours are brand new and they are relevant to what their needs are, as opposed to a container of mixed books. We've got access to about 800,000 books in our stock system at the moment, both here and in an off-site warehouse, which is used for bulk storage. What will then happen is another librarian set of people will make selections from the stock based on what our partners are asking for. So at the moment, we're doing three consignments. We're doing a shipment for Malawi, we're doing one for Uganda, and one for Kenya, all at the same time. We've already asked the partners what type of books they want and in what quantities, and what our job is to match what we've got with what the requirement is. So we will then produce pick sheets, and you'll see volunteers going around the warehouse with trolleys again, with a paper-based pick sheet, and they'll go around picking the books from the shelving, ready for packing.
Those are mostly books that have been requested, are they?
Sometimes you get a request by title, but usually it's by type. So they might say, can we have 500 medical books? What we will do for that type of donation, we will check on the library they're going to, because quite often they'll be in a university or a nursing college or whatever. We'll check what subjects they're actually teaching in that institute to make sure we're sending them the books that matches the curriculum as best we can. But it is very much matching as best we can. We don't have a budget to buy books.
What sort of proportion is it of the books that you wind up shipping out that is, say, fiction versus non-fiction?
Well, if I say the biggest category of books that we ship out is what we call CHIP, which is children's and primary, and that's about 60% of the books which we supply out.
60% by number rather than by weight?
Yeah, by number, yes. Yeah. So that's our biggest category. And then we have other categories, secondary and textbooks, and which will then make up the total.
And those children's books that you put in the CHIP category, that's mostly young reading book, so that's picture books or young fiction, or is that textbooks?
No, you're right in the first place. They're small children books, so they will be colouring books. Well, sorry, not colouring books, they'll be colourful books, books that really inspire children to want to learn to read.
And about how many books a year are you shipping out?
We ship out 1 million books a year.
And you're distributing to how many countries in Africa?
12, I believe, in Africa. We also do a small project in Palestine as well. But primarily, the books are all going to Africa.
That's a mixture of larger central libraries and smaller libraries. What's the kind of mix like of the places the books are arriving at?
Well, we supply books through partners in Africa. We're a small UK-based charity, and we can only do what we do with the support of the partners in country. So in most countries, we're using the National Library Service. So, for example, in Kenya, it's the Kenyan National Library Service. They will take the books and act as consignees, so they will deal with all the clearing element of the job when they get into Kenya. And what they will do, they will also forward on orders onto other beneficiaries as well. So they have a pivotal role in what we do.
And so that means that they're distributing the books that you send them all through the library system in Kenya?
Certainly through their national library system network, they will supply the books, and then they'll supply other beneficiaries that we might have identified as well, where we want them to benefit from the books that we get.
So that means they'll be arriving in larger towns or in smaller towns, or is it a mixture depending on their priorities set over there?
A lot of them will be going into the National Library Service in Kenya, so they're allowed to take up a portion for their use. So they've got a really good, strong public library system. But we also have community libraries and lots of other places where the books will go to. So, for example, in Kenya, where we supply books into the slums, into the Mathias Slum Project, and that's where the books are really, really put to good use, where without our books, there are no books.
Is that something that, I mean, you've been to Kenya and seen the effect yourself?
Yes, I've been to that slum last year, and it's really encouraging to see what they can do with the resources that we donate to them and the impact and change it has on people's lives.
What kind of difference does it make?
Just having access. Well, the library, which I was referring to in the Mathias slums, is a safe refuge for children to go into after school. So they will go to school even in the slums, but they're living in tin shacks. So they can't study, they can't do revision at home. So this library, which has been built, is a safe place for them to go after school. So they will do revision for school there, but they also have all these wonderful books that we've managed to donate to them. So they're reading for pleasure, they're reading for educational needs as well, and it makes a real difference.
Whether it winds up on the shelves of a community library in Kenya or on a bedside table back in the UK, the next chapter in the life of a paperback is clearly the most important. But let's skim through the familiar magic of the reading experience, the pleasures and heartaches of passing a much-loved volume from hand to hand, and thumb our way on towards the final pages. Eleanor Rodder, manager at Oxfam's specialist bookshop in the heart of London's Bloomsbury, says that when we've finally finished reading them, the books we donate to charity allow you almost to read a life.
You can tell a lot about a person by their donation. So I like it when you get a family. So you've got dad stuff, mum stuff, and then some of the kids as well. It's kind of, yeah, you can tell everything about someone's life. I've had some absolutely amazing stuff. I'll give you an example. We had a lecturer sadly pass away from UCL, and we had all of his radical socialist books from the 70s, and then there was some kids stuff that was a bit older, and then like more kind of history and reading books when he was getting older. So actually, and he dated all of them as well, which is really nice.
You could really see the development of a reading life.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And how many books do you get passing through this shop every week or every month?
So, very roughly, we have about 8,000 to 12,000 books on the shop floor at any given time. We leave the books on the shop floor between 6 and 10 weeks, depending on like category and price and things like that. We did a kind of rough estimate for this, and like for a year, we think we have about 68,000 books pass through the shop floor every year. So that's a lot.
And what about Oxfam shops across the nation?
Well, it's tricky because it's hard to estimate because so many shops are different. But we know that 7.5 million books are sold by Oxfam each year, and that's based on last year's figures. So that's really, really good. None of the books that we get go to landfill. They're always reused or recycled. And some ways are really ingenious. So, for example, I know that they go into like tarmac mix and stuff like that. So that's kind of cool.
So you've got roads built on books?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, I mean, these books on the shelves here, they all look in pretty good shape. Do you think any of these books are coming round, as it were, for a second time?
Oh, definitely. I've had the weird moment where I've seen my own pricing from another shop come round for the second time. I know a lot of my regular donors and regular customers buy a book, bring it back next week, swap it. Like, it's a really nice kind of thing to see.
And what about the authors in all this? Do you ever feel sorry for them?
Well, it's tricky. I actually have some regulars who are authors. So one nice lady comes in once a week, and if she sees her book on the shelf, she'll sign it so we can get an extra couple of pounds for it. In Oxfam in general, lots of authors work with Oxfam and are very kind of big on secondhand bookshops. And it's hard because like book lovers just want to be able to buy books, and we're an avenue for that. And especially if you're a student or something, this is actually a very cheap alternative. So I hope that authors don't lose out. But at the same time, it's for a good cause.
Not only that, but you're also supporting a wider reading culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, if customers know that we're here and know that they can buy books from Oxfam online as well and get into the habit of coming into their local Oxfam shop to see what they've got, then I think that can only be a good thing.
Each book we print on paper is a time capsule, a vote of confidence in the future. But how long can a paperback survive as it passes from one reader to another? How many years can we expect to preserve our personal libraries on the living room shelf? And what about those lucky volumes that make it into more permanent collections? Deep under the London clay, the gentle whir of the air conditioning broken only by the rumble of passing tube trains, or the clanking of ladders as books are collected for the reading rooms upstairs, the British Library's lead curator of contemporary British publishing, Debbie Cox, introduces a few of the library's latest acquisitions.
We are in one of the basements in the British Library. We're a long way underground. You've just heard a tube train going by. And the ranges that we are looking at is where British publications that are going to be stored in London in storage are arriving, and this is where they're being shelved and where they will remain for quite a long period of time. So in front of me here, I'm looking at academic publications in the arts and humanities in the subjects and the types of material that we have deemed to be high use material that will be called up to the reading room quite frequently.
So what have we got on the shelf?
So on the shelf in front of us, we've got a visual history of art. We've got a text here on land law, another one. We've got Law in Spain, sitting quite close to David Bowie's writings about his own work.
How are these ones here that are on the shelves, how are these organised?
These are organised effectively in the order that they have arrived in the library. So we don't try and separate things underground into subject categories, because that doesn't matter. What matters most is that they can be found. And so that the shelves grow in a regular way, the most efficient way is simply as they arrive, they get a number that says, this is British Legal Deposit material, it's arrived in 2016, it's of a certain size, because that shows where it's going to be shelved, and then the order that it has arrived, so that the next thing to arrive will get the next number in the line and go on the end of the shelf. That way we don't have to leave gaps in between shelving. We can have one continuous run and everything can be found.
I mean, what kind of conditions do you keep this kind of book in the library?
The principal thing here is the stability of the environmental conditions and that they are constantly monitored. So we have a target temperature which is lower than a comfort temperature. It's slightly cool in here, but that has to balance the relative humidity, because warmer air can hold more moisture and cooler air is actually going to not retain so much moisture. You're going to get condensation. So it's like, if you've got a relative humidity of 50, which is fine at a temperature of 20 degrees. If you take that down 10 degrees, then you're going to cause condensation, because the air will not be able to hold so much moisture. So a certain temperature can support so much moisture, it can hold so much moisture, but you go lower, it can't hold that much moisture. It's change that is the damage, a very damaging impact on books, because books, paper is absorbent, and so they will absorb moisture, dry out, and that constant change causes damage.
So how do the stable conditions here compare with the, I mean, I'm thinking of my living room, which is constantly hot and cold, and what kind of effect does that have on the lifetime of a book?
Keeping books in good environmental conditions, which temperature and relative humidity are a big factor. Light is another factor, especially radiation from ultraviolet light through sunlight is very damaging. Stable conditions that are good conditions with no pollutants or insect infestations, that kind of thing, mould damage, all those risk factors can increase the lifetime of a book at least four times over. So, yeah, books are going to last longer here. In your living room, there are things that you can do to keep your books safer. And the simplest thing is that books that are bundled together like this, that shuts out some of the air and some of the damage. It makes them more stable. Books that you spread out on your coffee table to show off are not in such a good situation, especially if there's sunlight coming in through the window, fading the covers, fading the ink, causing the pages to yellow. So, yeah.
So if we've got them carefully bundled together on the shelves, what sort of lifetime should we be expecting for the books we have at home? I mean, will our great-grandchildren be reading our copies of Harry Potter?
The books that you have at home, keep them carefully, and yes, why not? I've got some books that from my grandmother, only a couple. They're looking a little jaded now. the books that we have here, if you think that we have books from the 15th century, I mean, we obviously manuscripts that are much older than that, but printed books from the 15th century that are still looking pretty good, we would expect these to last, well, certainly 500 years and hopefully more.
So if a contemporary modern paperback is going to last for another 500 years or so, how does that compare with other forms of storage? I mean, like the clay tablets that have lasted for thousands of years or the parchment manuscripts that you have here as well?
Well, when we say 500 years for the paperbacks, I fancy their chances for being around for a little bit longer than that, only based on knowing what our books from the 15th century look like. They're still good to go. Yes, some of them need conservation and they need very careful handling, but they're a long way from being useless. So comparing them, clay tablets, again, they'll last for thousands of years, but they're subject to the same factors in a sense of heat or physical damage or risks to those types of material. And electronic storage, well, that's another kettle of fish. Digital preservation is a challenge in terms of, yes, the physical storage that you're storing things on will last. It's whether you can access that, whether the software will have moved on. So that digital preservation is a question of constantly reviewing what you have, ensuring that you can access it, ensuring that it meets the software that you're using to actually get at that.
So is digital storage the future for the British Library?
Not entirely, no. Digital storage is a huge part of what we're doing, but these books that are being digitised, we're going to store the books. We don't digitise a book and then get rid of it. So, no, multimedia storage is the future for the British Library, that we are storing print, we're storing papyri from the 3rd century BC, we're storing a whole range of media, and that's going to be important. Obviously, digital storage is the thing that is growing at the fastest rate and the thing that is occupying our minds to a very large degree.
When Hodder and Stoughton's Joanna Seaton thinks about the future, the picture she conjures up is filled with present-day concerns. What do you think the scholars of the 26th century are going to make of our 21st century publishing?
I think they might spot a couple of typos. Because one of the things that we are doing now in order to sell as many books as we can is trying to publish as quickly as we can. So sorry to talk about the past, but in the good old days, we would have a really long time to put a book together. And now much more, we are trying to be reactive and to be flexible. So if something happens or there's an event, or we're just trying to publish as quickly as we can so that books are immediate rather than a year after something happens, we get a book out.
So the book becomes much more of a kind of record of the moment.
Yes, absolutely. And obviously we're all trying to, because we're trying to sell as much as we can, so we're trying to react to trends as well. So if one sort of book suddenly becomes popular, so the colouring books, for example, I know they're not word books, but everybody immediately was trying to do colouring books and do them really quickly. No typos in those.
And what about your own contribution? Have you ever totted up about how many books you've produced in your career so far?
No, I don't like to do that.
You say 10 million books a year from Hodder.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you say you have a hand in those 10 million books every year, then over a career of 20, 30 years, that's a staggering number of books.
Yes, it is. Yes, but I love books, so that's great.
And with all those millions of books winging their way around the world, this week's story ends. For more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us on the Guardian website, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or even on your smartphone. Just spark up your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Little Deaths by Emma Flint is out in hardback and ebook, or you can download the audiobook right now from audible.co.uk. This is an exclusive extract.
So that was how it began, with a locked door to an empty room, with her running out into the street, a set of sweat-slick keys held tightly in her hand, pressed hard into her palm, with her circling the block, calling their names. It began with anger. If they've climbed out the damn window again, they'll be in a whole heap of trouble. And then the anger faded to a gradual awareness of her uneven breathing, of the sickness in her stomach. A realization, as she came back to the corner of 72nd Drive, that her skin, her hair were wet. She turned both ways, unable to decide which direction to go. The wrong choice could mean. It could. She bit her lip to kill that thought, turned left. So many kids. Every gleam of fair hair was a jolt to her heart. Then she saw a little boy ahead of her, and there was something about his walk. She grabbed his arm and spun him around. Frankie, what the f-? She looked into the face of a stranger and dropped his arm. Saw his mouth open. Barely registered his rosebud mouth breaking into a howl. Barely heard his mother. Hey! Hey, lady! What the hell do you think? She walked on faster until she lost sight of where she was going. Kept her eyes fixed on the faces that passed her, on the sidewalk ahead. She walked unevenly, avoiding the cracks. Step on a crack and break your back. Step on a crack. Kids ain't coming back. She saw a figure hurrying toward her, realized it was Carla Benelli. Saw the woman's lips moved, managed to get out. Frankie and Cindy, they're, I can't find them. Help me find them.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.